We're now beginning the 23rd chapter of Joshua. In this chapter, we have the first of two farewell addresses that Joshua gives to the people. The first address is in this chapter. The second one is in the 24th chapter, which is the last chapter of the book. So we begin with the first verse. And it came to pass a long time after that God had given rest unto Israel from all their enemies round about, that Joshua waxed old and stricken in age, and Joshua called for all Israel. Now, let's notice several things here. First of all, the time that he did this, the time that he called the people together and gave them this address, was at a time when he had waxed old and he was stricken in age. And many think this is the last year of Joshua's life, which would be when he was at the age of 110, and after he had been in leadership of this people for some 25 years. Now, the place of this is not stated here. Some think that it was Joshua's hometown of Timnath-Serah. However, it is more likely that it was someplace like Shiloh, which is, of course, where the people would come at a regular time for the yearly feast, and where the central portion of the government and religion was located. Now let's notice to whom Joshua made this address. Verse 2 says he called for all Israel, and for their elders, and for their heads, and for their judges, and for their officers, and said unto them. This statement, all Israel, probably doesn't mean every last person in Israel. But he specifies here, he's calling for the leaders, for the great people, for those that are in authority, for those that are responsible for what goes on, and he describes them as their heads, their elders, their judges, and their officers. So that those who would be responsible for carrying out not only the making of the laws and the administration of the laws, but the dealing out punishment for those who failed to obey the laws, they were all there. So it would be a sizable number of people. It would have to be considered to be a great occasion, because some of these would have to come from a great ways off to have come from all the tribes. And so he begins his sermon by saying, I am old and stricken in age. And certainly Joshua at 110 was old. He himself now is beginning to feel his age. Remember, a similar statement was made in the 13th chapter, the first verse, when they were getting ready to divide the land among the tribes. That verse says, Now Joshua was old and stricken in years, and the Lord said unto him, Thou art old and stricken in years, and there remaineth yet very much land to be possessed. So he'd been in this process of aging for some time now, and as we begin this 23rd chapter, he states that it was a long time after the Lord had given rest unto Israel from all their enemies. So, the time here has been about 25 years after Joshua took command of this people. And so he can truly make the statement, I'm old and stricken in age. And as he sees this age coming on him, his time growing short, rather than to retire and say, I'm going to just sit back and do nothing, it seems that Joshua now becomes even more diligent, more busy, to try to see that this people doesn't stray from God. He gives them some definite guidelines to go on here, and so he's even more busy in the work of God. And so it should be with us. As we see age coming upon us, instead of relaxing and sitting back and saying, I'm going to turn this business of being a Christian over to others, I'm going to let others fight the battle of God. We need to get on into the forefront ourselves, use our age, our experience, our wisdom, our ability in the purpose of God, just as Joshua did here. And even though we'll be able to say, I'm old and stricken in age, we still will be carrying on a valiant effort for the will of God. Verse 3, And ye have seen all that the Lord your God hath done unto all these nations because of you. Now here he begins his discourse, and he's explaining to them what God has done. Now he doesn't go back any further than what God has done during his administration. I mean, that's far enough for them to have ample evidence that God has abundantly blessed them God has done so much for them that it's difficult to even be able to name all the things he's done. And the same is true of us. If we start looking at the great things that God has done, all we have to do is look in our lifetime, look in the short time that we've been faithful to God, and see what God has done for us and done to us. And that's what he reminds them of here. So he says, "And ye have seen all that the Lord your God hath done unto all these nations because of you." Now these nations that they had driven out of Canaan, at the time this happened, these were very formidable nations. They were nations that had high respect as nations go. Of course, today we have nations that are much larger and seem to have a lot more power. But at the time this happened, these nations were sizable nations. They were as big as you'd want to run up against. And they were great foes if they were opposed to you. And so that's what he's explaining here. You see what he's done unto all these nations because of you. For the Lord your God is he that hath fought for you. Now, he doesn't say that we have done this, I have done this, let's take the credit for it. He gives the credit right where it belongs to God. The Lord your God is he that hath fought for you. So that no wonder you were able to have these victories so easily. No wonder there was no question at all about who was going to win the battle, except in the case of Ai, and that was just simply to show that they had been disobedient to God and they'd have to stand on God's terms in order for God to fight for them. And so he gives God all the credit for having been the one to give them the victory. The Lord your God is he that hath fought for you. Now that's quite a good position to be in, to have God fighting for you, to have God giving you the victory. Now, of course, they did have to have an army. They did have to go into battle. They did have to suffer hardships. There was always that chance that some of them might be killed. There was always that chance that they would be unfaithful and consequently lose the battle. But this is the same duty today that a Christian has. The Christian does have to go into battle. He does have to prepare himself. He does have to fight hard against false doctrine and against sin and against being led away from God. But if he will stay faithful with God, then whatever his battle that he has to fight, he's going to be given the victory because it is your God that hath fought for you. Verse 4, "Behold, I have divided unto you by lot these nations that remain, to be an inheritance for your tribes from Jordan, with all the nations that I have cut off, even unto the great sea westward." And he's simply saying that he divided these nations that remain, this land and whatever people were left in this land, he divided them by lot. He gave the land to these tribes as an inheritance. And he said it's from the Jordan River over to the Great Sea. And because this had been given to them and divided them by lot, it was going to be their possession. So he says in verse 5, And the Lord your God, he shall expel them from before you, and drive them from out of your sight. And ye shall possess their land, as the Lord your God hath promised unto you. Now there were a remnant of some of these nations still left in there. Some of the Canaanites were still there, some of the others. But he tells them very plainly in this fifth verse that the Lord your God, he shall expel them from before you and drive them out of your sight. You're going to possess the land. You shall possess their land as the Lord has promised unto you. So there still was some possessing to be done. But Joshua gives them very specific promise here that it will be theirs. God is going to drive these nations out and they're going to be allowed to possess this land. So it says in verse 6, "Be ye therefore very courageous, and keep and do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, that you turn not aside therefrom to the right hand or to the left." Now here we get the true nature of their army, of their ability to be able to conquer the land. He doesn't say go out and practice war. He doesn't say go out and learn how to march better, learn how to keep commands of your generals better, learn how to use new weapons to arm yourselves, to get more weapons and to out-arm the other nations round about you. those that you're going to have to yet drive out of the land. He says, first of all, be ye therefore very courageous to keep and to do all that's written in the book of the law of Moses. Now that's their job there. First of all, is to be courageous to keep and to do all that's written in the book of the law of Moses. To have courage is to have that confident feeling that you're going to be able to do something. Now they're to have much courage. He says, be very courageous to keep and to do. They must feel that they're going to be able to accomplish the keeping and the doing of this law. Now, if they falter in the keeping of the law, if they grow faint-hearted, if they grow discouraged, if they begin to feel that they're not going to be able to do it, or it's just too much for them, or what's the use of keeping on trying, they stumble at the least little setback in the keeping of the law. Now, we're not talking about battles now. We're talking about the keeping of the law. Then they're going to grow weak and faint, and they're going to grow away from God. And this is a most important teaching for us today. When it comes down to the laws that God has given us, to the commands and instructions that He wants us to follow through, to the things that we're to abstain from and have no part of, and the things that we're to put our hand to and to really diligently practice and to do, then we're to have much courage. We're to have the feeling that we can do it and not grow weak, not have despair, not have depression, not have the feeling that we're going to be inadequate, but let us be very courageous to keep and to do. That's what we're trying to do here. Keep and to do all that's written. Now, when he says all that's written, that means just what it says. They could not pick out a few laws and keep those few and then let the rest of them go. They had to keep and to do all that's written in the book of the law of Moses. That you turn not aside therefrom to the right hand or to the left. They had to be very careful as to how they kept this law. They could turn aside from it. They could be led off astray one way or the other. It's not a matter of being too strict and over strict and being safe. It's a matter of being right. You have to be correct. You can't go too far to the left just because you're afraid of going too far to the right, but you have to stay on the path that's laid out then to follow. So you have to look both ways. Not only not to neglect to do, but not to also demand that somebody do something that the Lord hasn't required. We can't make a law where there's not a law, just as surely as we can't neglect a law where there is a law. So you're not to turn aside therefrom to the right hand or to the left. Now he gets more specific as to what he's talking about in verse 7. What applies to them here in this specific situation? There are many applications you can make of this principle, not to turn from the law to the right or to the left. But specifically here he's talking about the fact that they're in danger of taking up the habits and the patterns of these other nations around about them so far as religion goes. So he says in verse 7, that you come not among these nations, these that remain among you, neither make mention of the name of their gods, nor cause to swear by them, neither serve them, nor bow yourselves unto them. Now, they're not to even go among those nations. That is, they're not to intermingle with them. They're not to have social affairs with them. They're not to allow their ways and their practices to rub off on them. They're not to become familiar with what they do. These that remain among you, neither make mention of the name of their gods. You're not even to study about their gods. You're not to learn the names of their gods. You're not to be acquainted with their religious ways. And we find that today in our society, we find it most difficult not to do this because so much of idolatry has been perpetuated and handed down through tradition among the people. Many idolatrous practices are handed down to us today in the form of astrology or the keeping of the paganistic feast days. Most of the things that are found in such celebrations as the Christ Mass, which occurs at the winter solstice, such as the traditions involving mistletoe and the Yule log and the idea that little elves and fairies are working for someone called Santa Claus and so on. These are all paganistic ideas, not to be found in the Word of God, not to be worshipped or known to Christians. And so we can constantly find ourselves being reminded that these things exist, and people all around us continue to make mention of them. Every place you read, you're going to find this thing written about and talked about. And we're not to study about those things. God's people were not to do that, and they're still not to today. There's no good end to be served by perpetuating the idea of the existence of these paganistic beings. And God says here, neither make mention of the name of their gods, nor cause to swear by them. Now, they couldn't even make a covenant with the other nations round about them, because to do so, they would have to swear by the gods that these nations followed after. And they couldn't do this. They couldn't swear by them. They couldn't give any kind of recognition to them at all. And then he says, neither serve them, nor bow yourselves unto them. Certainly, you couldn't look upon them as being a god, in that you would give any kind of service to them, that you would give any kind of tribute at all to them. You couldn't bow yourselves unto them. You couldn't worship them or include them in your worship. And so he just gives a blanket statement in this seventh verse about absolute refraining from idolatry. That's what they were to do. And we today must also make an absolute position on this fact of idolatry. We're not going to serve it. We're not going to bow down to it. We're not going to swear by it, make any covenant, any agreement with it, and even refrain from making mention of the names. And what he means here is the passing on of these names in such a familiar way that you and your children and those round about you will give some kind of recognition to it as a god. We must continually bear in mind that these things are not to be recognized as gods. The only thing that we could have to say about them would be in condemnation of them, not in any kind of recognition or honor or respect to them as some kind of a deity. We have to be very careful not to attribute any kind of spiritual or magical powers to anything that God has not done so himself. And as we know, all power comes from God. All spiritual recognition goes to God. All religion, all service, all bowing down to must be to God, or to what God has required that we recognize as such. So he says in verse 8, what to do in place of that. You know, our lives are not just a void. Every time we take something out of our lives, God has something better to put in the place of it. He says, but cleave unto the Lord your God, as you have done unto this day. You've done this. You've been very good up to this point. You have not gone into idolatry. I'm very pleased with you. This is the message Joshua is giving. But he says, get closer to God. Cleave. Hold on to. Attach yourself to the Lord your God. Let him be the one that you lean upon. Let him be the one that you're holding on to. Let him be the one that you talk about. Let him be the one whose name you mention. Let him be the one that you serve and you bow down to, and that you swear by. You're not going to put anything else in his place. Cleave unto the Lord your God as you have done unto this day. And we notice it's a very nice thing that Joshua is able to commend them for what they have done. It's so nice that you've been faithful, that you've been a true people. And so I commend you for it. You've been very good right up to this very day. And so I'm reminding you, I want you to keep doing that. Keep having that kind of a spirit, that kind of a frame of mind. Then in the ninth verse, he reminds them of the reason why they should be so faithful to God. For the Lord hath driven out from before you great nations and strong. These nations that God had driven out from them were as great as any nations of the day. They were strong nations. They were well-entrenched nations in this land. They'd been there for years and years and years. And they were thoroughly rooted as natives of this country. And here this group of Israelites had come in as nomads off of the desert. No real government, no territory, not really an established nation at all. And because God had been with them, they were able to defeat these other nations and take over their land. And it really was God himself doing it. The Lord has driven out from before you great nations and strong. And we must remember this same principle today. Spiritual territory the church acquires today, it's God who will drive out those from before us. It's God who will give us the territory. It's God who will allow us to have the victory. And so he says further in that ninth verse, "But as for you, no man hath been able to stand before you unto this day." You've been victorious. Everywhere you've turned has been victory. There's only one exception to this. That was in the case of Ai. And of course that was because they had been unfaithful and had a sin in the camp. And when that was cleared up, they even were able to easily defeat the city of Ai. "No man hath been able to stand before you unto this day." Here again, this is true of all God's people in all ages. When they follow God, when they do the things that God wants, then no man's able to stand before them. They are invincible. And so he says in verse 10, "One man of you shall chase 1,000, for the Lord your God, he it is that fighteth for you, as he hath promised you." Now there are some nations left scattered among the Canaanites. The army has been practically disbanded of the Israelites. And they may say, "Well, how can we stand? How can we fight now that we don't have a good organized force?" Well, he said, "One man of you should chase 1,000. One of you is going to be as good as having 1,000 soldiers. For the Lord your God, he it is that fighteth for you, as he promised you." God's going to fight your battles. You're invincible. You can't be defeated. One man is as good as 1,000 when he's got the Lord fighting for him. And that's true today also. In all of our battles, although it may seem like it's just one person, only us that's fighting, we can fight 1,000. We can chase 1,000 because the Lord is fighting with us and fighting for us. We're going to close at that point. Till next time, this is NC Crouch saying goodbye, friends.